The F and Rad Snowboard Podcast is presented by Vans. Before we start the show, I had John Roth on last week and he spoke about Side Channel, the company he started with Dan O'Pendergrassi. They're about to start production on the OV, the mid-layer overall they've created for snowboarding and fishing and everything else you do outside. They have pre-production pricing right now, but it ends February 12th. Give it a look at sidechannel.ca and take advantage of the discount. Side Channel is a labor of love from some folks who have deep roots in the snowboarding scene. Season 6 of F and Rad is sponsored by Wired Snowboards, The Boardroom Snowboard Shop, Anon Optics, Ocean Rose Organics, and Top Quality Crow's Nest Barber Shops, Tribute Board Shop in Nelson, BC, and Stance Socks. Thanks to everybody that supports the show. Support also comes from Mount Seymour and Grouse Mountain. Awesome. I started working at the Boardroom Snowboard Shop back in 1993. The owner, Murray Fraser, stocked the store with amazing snowboards and the best boots, outerwear, and accessories that money could buy. And as the store grew, the Boardroom added locations, and Murray's commitment to quality, price, and service kept customers coming back. To this day, the Boardroom still stocks the best selection of the best quality snowboarding equipment with the best service in the business and a best price guarantee. Check out one of their store locations in Vancouver or North Van, or go to boardroomshop.com. This week's guest is Blaze Rosenthal. His part in Simple Pleasures is banger. Google it. Check it out. It's still good for today, man. It earned him a place among the legendary pros who get full parts in MacDog films. Blaze started M3, which helped launch many careers, including Chad Otterstrom's, and he now has a successful career in art, which has earned him some real renown. He's humble, so I started out by reminding him that he was kind of a big deal in the 90s. Like, there was a point where you were the man, dude. Sick.
I was one of the guys. Roan was definitely a whole special thing that, like, you know, like what he was doing was just on another level when he did it. Mm-hmm. And it was so interesting that he did it, didn't really seem to want anything from it other than to do it and kind of be left alone, which I always thought was pretty interesting.
So. Yeah, I've had Rayberg on the show, but I haven't had Roan because he's quiet.
He still snowboards a ton from what I understand.
Yeah, I was tracking him down in California. I went down to Encinitas last year. And he was down to go for a split, but he was like, I don't know about recording though, which is fine.
Yeah, I mean, I remember because my friend Tamas rode for Ride, and so he was, you know, close to Dale, and I mean, I know Dale too, but Tamas would be with Dale, and those guys were all, we thought they were super, you know, they were the coolest guys, Dale, Ron, and Nate, and so we'd go to Squaw and Dale would be there and he'd tell stories about like, yeah, Roan just puts his hood, wears a black jacket, puts a hood up and go ride something and nobody knows where he is. So,
oh, that's sick.
I always think people that like, that do it and do it at that level and kind of open it up the way he did, but don't really want like the limelight for it or just whatever, you know, for whatever reason, he sort of just went his own path. I think that's interesting.
Yeah, I think there's certain guys that come to mind. Like, there's a story someone told about being in the Squaw backcountry and seeing Damian Sanders backflip off a cliff for no cameras, just because like that was what Damian would do. You know?
Right, right. He was. I met him. I went to. He was my favorite snowboarder when
Mine
I was
too.
Real young. I had the haircut. I had the board. I did it all.
Me too.
And I went to Japan with him for this little startup brand that didn't ever actually happen. And it was really cool actually getting to meet him because this was like kind of after his prime and everything. And I was just like an unknown snowboarder. Like I had whatever, a little bit of recognition, and he was so famous over there and he was still just really casual, really nice, really easygoing. I actually grew up in an area where his brother grew up in the foothills and would skate and like see his brother from time to time, his younger brother, who was like exceptional too, like just a talented family, I guess. We were on one side of this really rural kind of redneck county and they were on the other, little slightly more affluent, slightly more like kind of in the know side, and went to different high schools. But they would have skate contests over there, and we'd drive all the way, you know, and it was far. It was like an hour or something.
Right.
And we would drive over there when we were like young, or we'd get a ride from our parents, and we'd skate with those guys. And I like saying Damien's cool because he is, and I didn't know him that well.
He and Chris have been such a impactful brother duo in snowboarding, right?
Sure.
I wasn't sure where you originated. You know, like for whatever reason, I had you in Oregon.
No, I was born in New York. My family's from the East Coast, and we moved to California when I was pretty young. Mm-hmm. And then my mom moved around a lot, and she grew up like in Manhattan. Actually, she grew up in Queens, New York City, though, but went to school in Manhattan and like was just always had the dream of living in the country. So we were living in the Bay Area in like the late 70s, and she met a guy who had a piece of property, and we moved up and lived in the foothills on this piece of property out in the middle of nowhere.
Wow.
And I had friends from the city. So like I was in, you know, my best friend lived in Oakland. So I was into skateboarding and things from being friends with them. But then I lived in a place where there was no concrete, no people. So that's why we'd like drive super far. You know, like I was in the days when if you saw someone with a snowboard or a skateboard, they were kind of automatically your friend. Like you'd work anything out to be friends with them because there were only a few and everyone hated you.
Yeah.
So it was always to go to the other side of the county and see like those kids who were a little more in the know and had access a little more to like the broader skate culture. So
I can remember contests like driving 4 hours or 5 hours to go to some bigger city.
Right.
Yeah.
I mean, I remember going to like Stockton and Modesto, which are these like Central Valley, California cities that I don't want to disparage anyone's home, but like they are not that great, you know, as far as whatever. Right. They're not known for being, they don't have great reputations. And they're certainly not San Francisco or LA when it came to like skate culture or anything that.
Right.
But we'd go to Modesto and we'd meet kids who like could do no complies and slappies and things and just be like, oh my God, it's so amazing.
The scene is happening.
Yeah, try to figure all that out. So
it was such a fun time in, like, I've been thinking about a lot lately how, not a lot. I thought about yesterday when I just looked and, you know, how random things are just skate blocked and you're like, nobody would skate that anyways.
Right.
It's like a rash that happened to the built space that people just like, they make something that's designed nicely and then there's a bunch of like just metal bolted to it all like lame. Like it's like the world is ugly because of
you take clean lines like what would otherwise be things that are designed to be like aesthetically appealing in some way and they ruin it by putting up, you know, it's like having a beautiful, you know, lawn and then having a big sign that says stay out or whatever.
Yeah,
you know, it's like it's just, you spoil it. It just spoils it for everyone.
And it's also like a sign of fear. Like, oh no, we don't want the skateboarders taking over this place. And then there'll be, you know, skateboarders here drinking and smoking and swearing. And like, it just has that kind of feel.
They will be. But I don't know. You know, like now everyone just skates parks, you know, like it's like skate park culture or whatever, but that's not even skateboarding to me. Like skateboarding to me was the adventure of it, you know, it was skating some weird refrigerator that was in a back behind a, out behind a supermarket that fell over and you're like, you know, using it as a ledge and then using some little piece of plywood you found so you can pop up high enough to get, you know, like
totally.
Even in snowboarding, I feel the same way. I'd always rather ride garbage than some perfect super park or something like that. But it's, I mean, skateboarding was so much about going out and using all that stuff. And I can kind of understand where somebody sitting in their office trying to get work done, a bunch of skaters skating the handrail out front isn't the most relaxing sound. But when you're a kid, you don't think of that.
Yeah. I don't know. Well, like what would be so bad if everything was skatable?
Well, it's hard because we always said, well, hey, if we had skate parks, we wouldn't be here. And then they build all these skate parks. And now it's like, that's boring. I don't want to go to the skate park. I want to skate that thing. But I try to be respectful of the fact that other people have whatever needs they might have. And, you know, I can definitely see why clack, 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 you know, like grinding a rail right out in front of their place doesn't seem appropriate to some people.
Yeah, even wax on a curb. To me, that looks beautiful. But like I could imagine the person that goes and goes, hey, they ruined that thing.
For sure. No, yeah. Perfectly waxed ledge with like grind marks on it. Just yeah. Like, so still, even like at my age when I don't haven't skated for a long time, you know,
yeah,
it still looks aesthetically appealing. It's still like
totally,
you know, beautiful, but it's I can definitely see where the architect doesn't think so, you know, like
yeah, the designer.
I can see where the property owner doesn't think so. And, you know, I guess that's the public sphere. We're all
skateboarding really makes you look at the world a different way. Hey, like that, like what you sure. were just talking about. I remember a new building complex going in and us being like, oh, like loading bays. Now we finally sure, have right. like some transition right. to skate. Like it was for like sure. exciting when you would go around construction sites to see, is there materials we can steal so that we can make our own skate park? Or are they going to build something that is skatable? Like
sure.
constantly.
Well, and I often wonder too, because I think people that skateboard are often creative in other ways, you know, and like good artists or start interesting brands that are, you know, have cultural impact or, you know, all sorts of things, filmmakers, et cetera. And I think that I don't know if it's the people that have that capacity for that type of thinking end up skateboarding or succeed at skateboarding, whereas somebody that doesn't is just not going to get very far, or skateboarding tunes your mind to like think that way, or it's probably a bit of both, I guess.
Yeah, I think, you know, it's like probably definitely a bit of both.
Yeah, if you don't have some perseverance and some open-mindedness and some creativity, you're not going to go that far in skateboarding. But at the same time, if you do get into it, it's going to show you a new way of looking at a lot of things. It did definitely, it made my reality like a million times better than it would have been without it. So, I mean, I was a little, you know, like kind of hippie kid from the East Coast and then the Bay Area, ending up in like a rural place where everyone was like, you're weird. We don't think we like you, you know? And they felt that way for a long time. And, having skateboarding and everyone hating you for that made me just like, well, I don't care that you hate me, because you're going to hate me anyway for this thing that I like to do. And you hate all my friends too. So,
yeah. So how do you transition into snowboarding? Cause that's pretty far from
Yeah.
You're pretty close to like an hour away or something from Big Bear or something.
I was about 2 hours from Bear Valley and about an hour and a half from Kirkwood. So not that perfect. Far. And really we would go ride this little mountain called Iron Mountain, which isn't open anymore, but it was about 15 minutes before Kirkwood. It was low.
Mm-hmm.
And so like the mountain went down from the parking lot instead of up, which caused certain problems when yeah. we'd show up without lift tickets and drop in and think we'll get away with it. And then they'd check us and we'd have to run and hide in the trees. And we got in some trouble a few times, but eventually like the season passes were like $100 for students or something. So we just committed and we would ride there. And it had really good terrain. So we weren't that far. And what happened was, I got into skateboarding for two reasons. One was my best friend lived in Oakland, buddy of mine named Jacob, and he was a skateboarder and he was just so much more tapped into everything, you know, punk rock music and mm-hmm. all the right clothes, how to cut your hair, like everything cool. And I lived in a place where like everyone was a football player and wore like, you know, you were either a metalhead with like a big hairband dude or a jock basically. And I mean, everyone's got their own thing. I'm old enough now to know that it's all just stuff, but
yeah.
But at the time it was like, this isn't me. This isn't me. And he would do things. I was like, boom, I want that. I want to be a part of that. And all those kids always kind of in the city kids always thought I was a little off, you know, cause I was just like a hillbilly to them, but I also wasn't a hillbilly cause I came from like pretty intellectual parents that grew up, you know, from New York. And so it was really weird. I actually never really felt like I fit in anywhere, but, so I would skate because he skated, but then I also actually, his family took me for my first ski trip when I was like 10.
Rad.
And if you go from living in a place where where you don't feel like there's a lot to do and you're bored all the time, and then you go skiing, like, I'm not the biggest fan of ski culture. I have friends that are skiers, I guess, here and there, but like, I just like snowboard culture so much more. It just seems mm-hmm. so much more reasonable to me and whatever. I don't want to criticize, you know, but regardless, if you do it, it was fun, man. Like skiing was fun. We were 10 and we were cruising around. It was just me and my buddy. And it's like this whole mountain and like I remember like going from not knowing how to do it at all to by the end of the week being pretty solid intermediate skier, you know? And so I got into that. So I just had this love for skiing. The mountains were right there. And so every once in a while, cause it was kind of out of our, it was not like we were, it was, we were not on the side of the tracks that I did not grow up on the side of the tracks that people went skiing, you know?
Like, yeah. Yeah.
Like that was, ski vacations were not a part of my reality, but my mom would do everything and scrape everything together and take us like one day in the season. So I might've gone between the being 10 and 15, I might've gone like five more times in my life. I remember finding some skis at a garage sale for like 10 bucks and being like, boom, I'm set.
Nice.
Ski boots too. Some stretchy like telemarketing pants, I think, you know, the whole thing. I outfit for 20 bucks.
Yeah.
And so my buddy, a really good high school friend of mine who I started snowboarding with, his name was Leif Metzger. He's still a friend of mine. He works for Patagonia, really good dude. And he and I would ski. His mom would take us or we'd figure something out. We'd go ski a couple times this one season and we'd start to see snowboarders up there. And Leif was like, I'm going to snowboard. And I was like, man, that sounds expensive. I just got skis. We were skateboarders. So like we were completely committed to skateboarding, but, and you know, I hadn't thought of snowboarding because it wasn't like not anyone was really doing it. But then we started seeing it. He was like, no, I'm snowboarding. I was like, oh, good. Well, you're not going to snowboard without me. So I did everything I could do to would do this job washing dishes and then go across the street to the like local town hall, mop the town hall. I'd get up in the morning, dig a ditch, whatever. I made like 500 bucks. I bought a snowboard and some bindings. I had some old Sorels that I found somewhere. I stuck some ski boot liners in there like I was told to do that I like found from the, they were like the ones that were in the ski boots I was using that I had bought at the garage sale. And we went snowboarding and it was just, we were wearing, I remember we were wearing Jimmy Z's pants, the ones that would Velcro close.
Yep.
And I don't know if you know what happens when you get Velcro wet, but it doesn't work anymore. So first day of snowboarding, me and my friend Leif are soaked and just trying to launch off everything. And we'd launch off and like our pants would fall down in midair and we'd land. And we were just, we couldn't believe how good we were after one day, which was good enough to like, good enough to point it to the jump, fly off and land on our back. You know?
Yeah, totally.
It was so good. Man.
There's a feeling in snowboarding that all of a sudden you can do all these things you wished you could do on your skateboard. Like you can grab for your sure. board, you can blast like 10 times as far. Like it was,
for sure.
It was definitely to someone who's committed to snowboarding or to skateboarding. Snowboarding was like easy. Like it was like, oh, this is so easy compared to falling.
Well, it was interesting too, because skateboarding, there's like places you can ride and there's places you can't. Like some concrete, mm-hmm. especially where we grew up, the limited surfaces, there were places where like, oh, that street's too rough. Like we don't go that way. We always go this other way. Or, you know, like, oh, you can ollie up onto this part of the sidewalk, but then there's dirt after. So you like, you don't ride on the dirt or whatever.
Yeah.
Snowboarding, everything was open, like open, you know, like you could ride anywhere. It was, and so I just remember thinking about these banks and transitions and like wanting to go up and do blunt, because back then we didn't really do blunt slides, but we'd do like blunts on parking block and you'd just go up and blunt, pop off, but go up and do a little tail block thing. And it's funny because we started out like totally grabbing behind our feet and doing all those types of tricks.
Yeah.
And thinking about it from a skateboarding perspective and putting like, you know, like a Vision Gone sticker on your board or whatever.
Totally.
But then we started watching those falling movies, the early ones. And like Damian Sanders just had that like, we're like, whoa, what's that dude all about? You know, like, and so we got into, and I remember like, other people that were like, no, man, you got to grab up on the tip of the board and you got to do this. And we were like, all right, well, we love snowboarding. We just want to do it right.
Yeah.
And we didn't have the sort of wherewithal to stick up for our skate roots at the time. So by like within a couple of years, we started in our junior year. By our senior year, we were definitely riding avalanches and hard boots.
Nice.
And that lasted for about a year. And then I remember moving to Sacramento and just like seeing Chris Roach and you know, Cardiel and Noah Selaznik and just being like, that makes a lot more sense to me. And, you know, not that Damien was, but even Damien, like when Damien switched to soft boots, it was like, there was no arguing anymore. You know? Like the whole oh, it's really efficient edge to edge. Like that argument didn't work when he stopped. So.
I forget that there was there were people who were very vocal about, like, you know, hard boots are better. Like for Damien, hard boots were better for going big. Like even when he went
until
to
critical boots, condition, yeah. And then he ripped on, you know, like he ripped. I mean, I remember he was wearing Burton boots and wearing Ryan Burton bindings, those old freestyles. And like, you know, I had that, he had on the Damien Dagger.
Yeah.
I moved to Sacramento to go to community college and I had a little grant and I took all that money and bought a Damien Dagger and I spent everything. And then starved all year, but I had like the board I wanted. It was like a table. It was so stiff. But
and the hips on it were so abrupt. Like it was just so edgy.
Yeah.
And like
that board was gnarly.
It was hard to ride.
It was very difficult to ride. I only had that board like half the season. Then I got like the Aggression Tarquin Robbins and that was, and widened my stance for the first time.
Yeah.
And I think like 19 and a half inches was widening the stance. And I think that, like, I felt like a cowboy. And I remember going from that to like 20 and a half when I realized like that was the thing.
Yeah.
And 20 and a half was just like, I was so incredibly, you know, modern or contemporary or whatever.
Yeah.
You know,
man. That Tarquin boards would have been just like instantly your skate style.
Yeah. Well, it had like the hot, super hard P-Tex and it had the full twin. You could ride it either direction. Yep. And it was, that was the beginning for sure.
Did you ever get to meet Tarquin? Were you ever on a team with him?
No. I think I might've met him like at a trade show or something. By the time I met him, it was probably, I mean, I more heard the legends and like, I don't know. I know he got busted in Vegas with a gun or something. I'm not a gun person. And so like for me, I'm not a gangster. I'm not a gun guy. I'm sure he's an awesome dude. And
yeah.
Certain people like I would seek out. He wasn't.
He wasn't one of those dudes. So I'm curious what that first board was that you spent all your money on. I'm going to guess it was like a Burton Elite.
Well, that was the Dagger.
That was the 500.
Oh, the
very first board. Yeah.
Was a Kemper Freestyle.
Ooh,
and
lucky.
I bought it.
Lucky.
I had somebody buy it and they didn't want it. Like they must have got it because they worked at a ski resort and it was a guy that had graduated my high school and I bought it from him.
Oh, perfect.
And then my friend Leif, he got it. He got the same thing. So we had matching Kemper Freestyles with the green bindings. We had matching purple Columbia pants and blue Columbia jackets and matching like these like snowflake headbands. And he like had good long blonde hair that looked so good. And I was always jealous. He had, you know, cooler hair than me.
Oh, that is so dope that you guys had the matching pants.
Yeah. He was actually a better snowboarder than me off the bat too.
Those boards were really good, actually, for that time.
They were. And even that stance, interestingly enough, that was wider stance by like in relation to the era. And I remember going to the first Damien board I got.
Yeah.
And which was a total step backwards as far as everything.
Yeah.
That's how important pro riders are, which I don't think people realize. Is like I made that decision for one reason. Wasn't performance, wasn't quality. It wasn't the best way to save money, which would have been to keep the board I have. It was Damien Sanders was the only reason.
Right.
And so all the kids out there are getting a bum deal these days. It's like, come on. But anyway, that stance was super narrow and I didn't realize there was a difference. I kept just landing and flipping over the front. And I was like, why isn't this board working? You know, it was like, well, you just went from back to a 16-inch stance from a 17-inch one or something, and it's not as stable.
Where does the sponsorship stuff start happening?
I was just like a super enthusiastic kid, basically, mm-hmm. And I grew up in the foothills, and there wasn't really, you know, a skate or snowboard scene. But then I moved to Sacramento, and I moved there because the girl I was dating, or girl dating is such a weird word, I think, but she was my girlfriend. She lived there.
Yeah,
and I wanted to be near her. And here she's my wife now, so I guess that was the right decision.
Yeah, nice.
Like 30 something years ago. But I moved there and there was a great skate scene and snowboarding, and I was just like, I'd, you know, go hang out at the shops. First I'd go hang out at Go Skate for a long time. And I got a job there for like a day and I just didn't know how to deal with customers or anything. And like that they set me aside and they were like, you're not ready. You know, this isn't right for you. And so then I started hanging out at the shop called Mountain and Surf for a long time. And I would just they'd give me patches or whatever. And I'd sew them onto my pants. Like, you know, like I'm sort of sponsored myself by them.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
And then I got a job there somehow. And then when I had a job there, I like, you know, just to, simplify it, we were riding at a demo day, me and the owner, Dave Shear, and we were riding, you know, demoing the different boards, and we were riding around, and we were riding with Bob Klein, who now everyone knows is like an agent. He was Danny Cass's agent, I think, and does other stuff. But at the time he was the Santa Cruz rep, and we're riding with him, and I didn't know him. And he was like, you know, how much did you pay for that board, Blaze? And I was like, and I felt like I was riding pretty good. And I was like, you know, I got a pro form or whatever. And he's like, oh, you shouldn't have to pay for boards. And inside my head just went bing. I was so excited by that, just that statement.
Yeah.
And I sort of thought I might know where it would be leading to, but I had to like play it cool. So I was like, yeah, you know, well, if I want a snowboard and I need a board, so I got to buy one. He's like, how about I give you snowboards? And I was like,
yes,
that works, you know? So he gave me a board and I like mounted up in the parking lot. We shot a feature for this magazine called Heckler. That was a little Northern California magazine it was the very first issue. And it was me just doing a frontside 180 over this snow fence.
Rad.
On that board. And that was like the beginning of all that.
What board would that have been? Was it like a Delta or one of those Tau?
It was the Tau where you switch around backwards so you can ride the wide stance.
Yeah, yeah, totally.
You either ride it the right way with like a racer stance or you switch it around and you have like 21 and a half or something. And
totally.
You ride like 15 minus 15.
Yep.
So
that's sick. Yeah, I had a Delta, which was the square end boards.
Yeah, I got that one too. I got that one afterwards.
That was a nice board.
I liked the Tau, like it was super wide. And the only way you could get the wide stance on that one was to like drill out your binding and move up and catch the last two like bolts and then catch the leash bolt.
That's right.
The hole they put into it so you could bolt your leash in.
That's right.
And then the thing was the stance was so wide. It was like 23 and a half or something. And the board was so wide. Like it was good, but it was definitely like when I got the Chris Roach board, that was better.
Oh yeah, yeah. That first Roach was with the Genie one.
Yeah, that was the first one I cut down, sanded it, and painted it khaki.
Oh wow.
And those
boards were made in Italy. Like I remember looking at the board and being proud of what I had. Like, wow, this is finished nice or whatever.
Chris Roach was definitely like one of my heroes. Like I always liked people that had style.
Yeah.
And at that time he was definitely the guy with the most style, I thought. So.
Yeah. Yeah.
He was somebody I looked up to and he was like right there. And then to have his board felt pretty cool. So,
that era of snowboarding is the coolest era of snowboarding.
For sure.
I love that.
I used to talk about that because like when I was in it, like it got to where everyone started really paying attention to what each other did and sort of mimicking each other. And it just got really in a way kind of a lot more boring because like, in that era, you had like Chris and Noah, but then you had like Sean Farmer and Damian Sanders. Like dudes were so different that there was no way you would mistake. Like they didn't just do the thing a little different. They were like totally different, you know, like totally bizarre characters in all these different ways. And it was just, it was a really interesting era for sure.
That's cool. You get to see these guys actually ride. Being from California, like you would be at a resort.
I mean, a little.
See these guys.
I didn't get to do that until I moved to Sacramento and started riding Donner.
Yeah.
And then by that time, those guys were all riding like Squaw. So
right.
I was like kind of always behind them. Like, cause I grew up riding like Iron Mountain and nobody was there.
Yeah.
I think one time we saw Jimmy Halipoff and Randy Walters from the chair.
Right.
I don't even know for sure, but they were like grabbing through the legs and they were on moss boards and they had like, they looked cooler than we were
that,
you know, we were hillbilly snowboarder kids. And, that was the only pro sighting I probably had until starting to ride Donner Ski Ranch. And then maybe like sometimes we'd see those guys there. And then actually for a while, gosh, it was weird to even think about this. Like I lived at Noah's house for a little while,
whoa,
like, because I worked in Sacramento, like I worked with, it's funny because Andy always mentions all this stuff to me. And I talked to him earlier today and he's like, are you going to talk about this? Or are you going to talk about that? You know, cause I was told him we were going to chat later. And I was like, I have one agenda. And like, my one agenda is basically to say that Chad Ottersham's like the coolest, best snowboarder ever. But that's like the only agenda I have. And I don't want this to be the time I do it. Like, let's talk about it later. But
yeah, absolutely.
That's my only agenda for this interview.
Red.
Everything else I want to just be like, whatever happens.
This stuff is so fascinating to me. How do you end up at Noah's house? Like, how does
I worked at Mountain & Serve.
Yeah.
And there's this guy, Matt, that I worked with that was my manager, lived with him.
Mm.
And I needed a place to live. And so Matt let me stay there for a little while I was figuring things out. So like, it wasn't for a long time. It was probably like a month or two in the fall, like before winter. And it was just like, you know, it was crazy. Cause like Noah and those guys always, I think like thought I was a little bit of a nerd because I really liked snowboarding and I really thought they were all really cool.
right.
And I wasn't that good at hiding it, you know?
I got you. And, that's me, dude. That's me.
Yeah. I was very enthusiastic, is how I would say it. And I don't regret that. You know, actually there's been times in snowboarding where I feel like everyone got kind of, the snowboarders themselves got too cool for it. And it didn't make sense to me. I didn't realize the moves to like SoCal or the, you know, whatever, the like only snowboarding when you're on a trip, or like for me, it was riding every single day, you know, when I was doing it. But anyway, like I landed up at Noah's house for this period of time. And I remember and he sort of tolerated me, and Noah was fucking awesome to be, you know, to be totally honest. The dude was so talented, ultimately pretty cool, pretty down to earth for how amazing of a guy he was. He was just part of, like, there's cool people in the world and there's geeky people. And I tend to like fall on the geekier, you know, side of that. Like I'm nerdy about the things I like and I'm super into them. And I don't always know how to keep myself composed when I'm around the like really suave stars of the thing. You
agreed,
know? And he
dude.
Was that.
Yeah, right? He was big time.
He was awesome, man. And I just remember like we would drive up in his sports car to Boreal and we'd go ride. And it'd be early season because obviously later in the season he had better shit to do than hang out with me. Like important things, right?
Trips.
Helicopters to fly around in and huge lines and whatever. It's stuff to do, you know?
Yeah.
Hatchet Brothers to go out snow filming with, whatever. And Mac Dog and all that. But we'd go up and we'd be riding down and he'd just be the smoothest guy. And I'd be thinking of a trick. I'd be like, oh, you know, I watched The Hard, the Hungry, and the Homeless, or Up in the Ante, or whatever. I can't remember which year it was that I lived with him. But those were also the two most influential films for us. But I remember I'd watch that and I'd be like, this trick. And he'd just like do it at, like shooting out of the bottom of the half pipe because there was no real jumps yet.
Yeah.
And he just like perfect, shifty, super late, whip it around and just like, oh man. It was really impressive to watch him in real life. He was really good at snowboarding. He was really cool. And there was a time at which, and this was the way it was back then, like pros, like Chris Roach was practically retired at like 25, you know, these dudes would snowboard for a couple of years, get a couple of video parts. And then like, it seemed like, and like, I remember as we aged, like feeling like, are we supposed to quit? You know, like, like there was this expectation that you were too beat up or you were over it or you were burnt out from partying too much, whatever. For whatever reason, Noah started doing less, right?
Mm-hmm.
And I was doing more. I filmed with Mac Dog and, you know, and started getting parts like in Stomping Grounds and stuff. And I remember feeling the shift where suddenly, like in some ways, like if, you know, I was, I don't want to say more popular than Noah, but like I was more of the moment than Noah, right?
Right.
And that could lead somebody to believe like I'm better than Noah, right? Like, there'd be a Mac Dog video where like Stomping Grounds, I have a full part. He has a little short part because he didn't get out there and get all the work done. But if you watch the snowboarding, which I have watched, not recently, but I've watched it.
Yes.
The way Noah dives into a turn, the way he comes into things, the way he'll grab tail all the way through a backside 720, like, but more than the way he does a trick, just the way he dives, like the way he comes into a turn with this weight, like, I can't even say, somehow it's like he almost nose dives into these turns in this graceful way that's just so dynamic. Like, I was never better than snowboarding than Noah Selaznik. I was never as good at snowboarding as Noah Selaznik. Like that dude was a talent on another level, like the Jamie Lynn Terrier, Peter Line level, where like when people ask me how, you know, how were you at snowboarding? I was like, oh, I was good. I wasn't the best, but I was one of the guys that was not the best. I was one of the good guys that was not the best. You know?
That's
like,
so sick.
Like those guys were clearly the best. And Noah was a talent at that level. I don't want to disparage Aaron Vincent or Chris Roach because those guys were both really good too.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if either of those guys were as good as Noah Selaznik either. You know,
no, like, Noah's the best. Noah's like, style, was, like you say. Yeah. I agree with what you're saying. Yeah. When you watch, see, the thing about the Noah stuff that I love is also in the background, the stuff that you don't usually recognize, like the filming. Right. The filming, like, it's like they got these lucky shots of him doing these amazing things. Like, it's just filmed so perfectly, and his style is just so pleasant on the eyes. There's no filler.
And like, so confident, dude. That dude, like, he knew he was amazing. He knew he could do it. He was in control. Like, I was always just like, what are we doing up here? This looks scary. And I forced myself to settle down and do it anyways. Cause I wanted to do it, you know?
Yeah.
And he just never seemed to have that. Like, he was just gnarly line in Alaska, throw some dip in his lip and drop in, you know, like
totally
crazy, you know? Whereas like, I would want a map. I would want full detailed rescue plan. Anyway. Yeah. He, you know, yeah, it's a tragedy that he's not still around, and it's a tragedy that he wasn't part of the sport for longer than he was, and more a part of its sort of the subsequent generations of it.
There was a reality where he got on Forum. If he would have been on Forum with that original Forum team, I think his career would have been another 5 years longer, or even more.
I mean, the bottom line is, I never knew the guy. I mean, I don't even know him that well. It's interesting that we're going into this depth because he was a part of the very beginning of my career, but I will say I never saw Noah be anything but a cool guy.
Dope.
I never knew him to do anything other than be a great snowboarder and have a lot of friends, enjoy life, party like crazy, and do the thing that we all think we want to do. And so some of it might've caught him in the wrong position, but not because it's anything that any of us could have gotten caught with if we, you know, had that level of fame and that level of access. And no doubt that was one of the great talents of our sport, you know?
Oh, 100%.
Yeah. So, and I do, the way we snowboard is we're indebted, you know, to this day is, you know, we're indebted to him and Chris and the guys that sort of pioneered this alternative path from the ski, or even, you know, the Damian Sanders, as much as I loved him, like that more flamboyant style. I would have loved to have seen him like run a company or be like, you know, the figurehead behind something, and he should have been. And some of how pros are so disposable is probably why I think a lot of them go down a hard road at a certain point in their lives. I mean, I know I had my own hard road, and it wasn't the same as Noah's, but I had it.
Who's your first sponsor? That's like, okay, so we already got that. That was Santa Cruz.
Yeah.
And then from there, do you move to one of these newer companies like an M3?
So that small brand that I got on with Damian Sanders for like 6 months until we realized like the people weren't going to be able to make boards and, you know, actually do anything, like, that was the next thing, and that lasted for a very short period of time. But what happened was I was riding, and I guess I was riding Squall at the time, and Dave England was living there. I don't know how we even sort of got connected, because I don't think I really knew him. Maybe I knew him a little bit, or maybe I sort of met him through the ride guys that my friend Tamas would be with, but I don't actually remember, but he got me on Silence, and that was like, that was the beginning of kind of being a real snowboarder. Like that was the real brand. I was on with cool guys, him, Cody Dresser, Matt Smith, super good style, a brand that had like Santa Cruz was cool, but it was a little slashy, kind of weird, kind of Euro. Like, it wasn't really my style, you know, and even this other brand that we were trying to do with Damien, like at that point, it was like, I wasn't really, you
what
know,
was
it was
the
not
brand?
Really. It was called Aurora, but like, I almost don't want to promote it just because it was such a weird thing that I think might've been like some Japanese guys hustling some investors or doing, I don't know. I was 18 or something, you know, I was a kid.
Cool.
I, or 19, you know, like I didn't know what was going on.
Yeah. Yeah.
I just knew that like they said they'd do things and then those things never happened. And then we were told to just go buy other snowboards and they'd pay for them. And like, you know, so I think like, you know, I can't remember what
I think Damien talked about it.
Well, I was right. Maybe he did. Yeah. And I was riding a ride is what I was riding. Cause I would ride Tamas would give me some snowboards.
Oh, sick.
That. So I was riding a ride like the whole time. And, but then, yeah, then Dave England got me on Silence, which was
I had
just,
no idea Dave England was affiliated with Silence.
Smith. Him and Matt Smith started Silence
from the Joyride team. So like they
right
were on,
Joyride. They left Joyride together, started Silence, with Trent. And then they got Cody cause Cody was another Joyride kid that they, you know, that was their like up and coming kid. And then Dave got me and
sick.
Like, and, yeah. And I was really proud to be on that program and with those guys. And then like, yeah, they took me to Japan and we did all, it was the first thing where like I'd fly to Carlsbad and you'd have that classic back 90s snowboarder experience where you go to Carlsbad for a meeting and like, whatever, go home with some snowboards.
Yeah,
and,
man.
You know, get treated to dinner and maybe pick up a paycheck or something like that.
Dude, that's so sick. Yeah. I remember Silence cause Rob Dow rode for them a little bit later on too.
Okay, I do kind of remember.
Yeah, and we
Ian Reuter, like the team got pretty big. Eden Carter, there was a bunch of rad guys on there later on. It kind of unfortunately was sort of I feel like imploding at that point. So like there was a short period of time where some of those guys were on, like Ian was on, and Ian was super like progressive, like you couldn't tell if he was riding frontwards or backwards,
totally.
And like just it was trippy to ride with him. Yeah. And so there was this moment and I wish it would have worked out, but
yeah, just year after year, I remember the product being, you know, pretty on point in the beginning and it was just like, it was just a time in snowboarding where everything went crazy and there were so many brands. So like we would bring in to the store that I worked at, if we brought in 25 or 50 Silence boards, that was a huge order because of how, because we had 50 brands of boards.
Sure.
And so like every brand would be like, well, we need you to make a bigger order next year. And it's like, well, then we have to cut like 80 brands, but who do you cut and who do you, and I think Silence made it through a bunch of cuts for us.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I think the problems that brought it down might've been more manufacturing based and internal, just like problem, like too, you know, like so many brands, like, I mean, the same thing happened with M3. It was so expensive to make boards in the States. And then we had, you know, if the boards didn't hold together, you were replacing a board that you had a small margin on with another board and losing money on the deal.
Totally.
And it was, you know, cause M3 was, people liked it. It was working except for it wasn't financially working, you know.
So you did go to M3. I
started M3.
Oh, that was your deal.
Yeah, you didn't know that.
I thought it was the guy who owned the soy sauce thing.
Well, he owned it. I started it. So what happened was this, this is how M3 came about. Chad and I were on Silence and it was going through its various iterations, like being sold to this other company in Seattle, and you know, and we got new client, like you never knew year to year like what's gonna happen, right. So it ends up they're like, we're not gonna have a team, so we all are sponsorless, and we go to Mount Hood because we all worked at High Cascade back then. Like I would just kind of hang out. They'd let me hang out all year, which was amazing. But Chad was a digger and like, you know, so we were all up there and I broke my foot like and so I was getting like some little, like I was 24 at the time, you know, people wondered if I had had it, you know what I mean? Like, cause that's how the thinking was back then.
Totally.
And, I was getting like interest from this company called MLY, which was Molly, and then became LY. And it's like, and they were like really pursuing me and they sent me some boards and they looked good. And I was just like, that is just not a cool snowboard brand.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't want to be on a brand that isn't cool. And I don't care how much money it is. It's just not my thing. And so, you know, I'm up there and it's the first week of camp and I, I had talked to a couple other people, but I had no real leads. Like, no one really was going to make it happen that I could tell. So I break my foot skateboarding like the first week, and I'm scheduled to be there all summer. So it's like, well, what do I do? Like, it's like, do I go home? What am I going to do? So I was like, you know, I'm just going to hang out here and be around it. Like, I wanted to be around it. And so I had crutches and I'd just hang around every day, and I'd hang out with some kids and watch some movies with them or whatever, and see my friends. But like, I was pretty miserable. And I just kept thinking, like, what am I going to do? What am I going to do? And I finally, like, had this idea. And I told the guys, I was like, look, I'm not ever going to ride for MLY. But what if we do a brand? Like, you guys have the factory. You guys have the thing. What if we do our own thing, you know? And they were like, I can make something cool. And he was like, oh, you know, they came back and they were like, what if, you know, like, what if it's like a thing by MLY? And like, we found this compromise. And so Chad, at the time, I was 24, which was perceived as possibly old, right?
Yep.
And I'm injured. But Chad was like, he was this kid that was like pretty quiet and sort of like, we were close and he hung around me, and for some reason he trusted me, and he didn't have a sponsor either. And he was like the best snowboarder that I could think of. And that includes the greats. Okay.
Yeah.
Like,
yeah.
I don't want to say Chad was better than those dudes, because those dudes were really good, but Chad was as good as them.
Mm-hmm.
So I think so anyway. And the weird thing is he's kind of still,
he's still that good. It's even better now. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. He's even better now. He's so good.
Yeah. When any movie that he's in, just that he has a part in, like, a lot of the spots, they hit the same spot. And the and that his landing is so far past where everybody's been
and just
landing.
His technical ability, man. Like, we would be, I remember sussing out this jump in the backcountry in Utah, and it's like, it wasn't even dug in yet. We were like just riding down to go over the hip a little bit to see if it was like a good lead in. And I rode down and kind of ollie it. Mitch Nelson comes down and kind of ollies it. Someone else does. Chad comes down, boom, off his heels, frontside 720 melon off it. Like, no takeoff, no nothing. And I'm just like, you know, and that's when you're a pro and like self-loathing is totally running high, and you're just like, I hate myself. I hate myself so much right
totally,
now.
Totally, totally. The pressure is so on right
now. Yeah.
Oh, man.
So the thing is, Chad was so good, man. And I just, for some reason, he like, you know, I mean, we were close, but for some reason beyond that, like, he seemed to trust me or something. And so he was like well, look, I don't know if I believe in myself, but I believe in you.
Yeah.
And I know that I have these ideas. And we talked about and talked about. I was like, and eventually I was like, look, if, you know, if you'll do it, I'll do it. And we shook hands on the deal.
Wow.
And that was like, with that handshake, I felt like I owe this kid everything. Like, it has to go well for him.
Right.
You know?
Right.
And then we had, my friend Kendall Welton, who I knew through Chad, another Colorado kid. And I say they're Colorado kids, but they all came from other places and like, you know, but that was where they returned to every winter from Mount Hood. And then there was Brad Chaffell.
Yeah.
He was already on MLY and we pulled him over to ride for M3.
Brad.
And I had known him since like when I rode for Santa Cruz, like years before, cause we like both coached at USSTC, and he's just, Brad was a cool guy, wasn't his one. And then Scotty Whitlake was this kid. And it's funny because Scotty Whitlake and like, you know, I do other things mostly now. Like, I'm not super involved in snowboarding anymore. I do snowboard, and I love it.
Right.
And I actually do like ride. Corey gives me spring break boards and I try to like shoot some turns or a method here or there and send, you know, for Instagram or whatever. And it's fun to have that outlet.
Yeah, man.
But the truth is, like, I'm a painter, you know, that's what I'm a fine artist. Like, I don't even like the word fine artist, but if you just say painter, people think you're like painting houses, which is nothing wrong with that either.
Yeah.
But like, I'm thinking about and doing other things most of the time. But when I do think about snowboarding, like, you know, and I think about my involvement with it, I think I was a pro, sure, and I had some impact, sure, but probably the very biggest impact I had in snowboarding was like, discovering Scotty Whitlake and giving him a platform to sort of become a pro snowboarder, and the way that his impact affected snowboarding for like the next 20 years. I mean, he just changed so much about it. with the way that he thought about things, the persona that he had, et cetera. And when I started M3, Scotty was this kid sleeping in a little teal green Subaru Impreza on the side of the road at Hood and hiking up to the glacier every day.
Awesome.
And he had nothing. He had nothing. I think maybe he somehow got a Division 23 board here or there. So yeah. I don't want to say like no one had given him anything.
Right, right, right.
And I knew him because he was like this kid at Squaw Valley, and he went to Squaw Valley Academy. And I kind of, I knew him from that, you know, from seeing him a little bit around there. And I just remember seeing this kid and just thinking like this company, this brand is all about us loving snowboarding, and we're all the outcasts and the misfits. We don't fit in anywhere. Right. Forum sucked up all the like super cool guys. Right?
Sure. Sure.
And
yeah.
We're all just, you know, like we're all just these sort of like weirdo snowboard, not weirdos, but nerdier or like less connected or whatever. I don't know what it was.
More heart. You have way more heart.
I don't
You're
want to
there.
Say we had more heart because I believe all those other guys really loved it too. And
yeah,
they went
is
out
true.
And busted their asses. They just yeah. had a different way of expressing their love for it. And maybe they were just better at like, if I could be as cool as Devin Walsh, I'm not going to tell you I wouldn't do it. You know, like
yeah.
I never figured it out. I never figured it out. If I could walk into a room and be that cool, I probably would do it.
Yeah.
But it isn't who I am, you know? And I've learned to accept that over the years. But I would say that, So you know, when I saw this kid doing this, I was like, I don't even care how good you are. You love this more than anyone. Like you're literally walking 3 hours a day to snowboard up this glacier. And, you know, and I would just look at him like standing on the side of the road with his hand in his pockets. And he had these like tattoos on his arm, and he would wear these just baggy 501s and a white shirt. And I was just like, dude, I don't know what it is, but I can just tell like you are the thing. Like yeah. this is something. And he would like strap in. He wasn't really even that good at snowboarding. And he would just like ollie like something. And I'd just be like, oh man, that is what snowboarding should look like.
Rad.
You know? And so we put him on and he actually helped, like he drew these graphics for the first boards that sort of helped turn into like, it was just this logo, you know, but somehow turned into the, like, you know, it wasn't exactly what happened, but the artist, you know, everyone sort of had an equal voice from the beginning, and his was, we valued him. So we got him, and then we just kept working at it. And like, we got like my, who would it have been? I think probably Brad Chaffel was the one saying, hey, Mitch Nelson just came back from his mission and he's going to need a sponsor, you know, whereas JP had like rocketed off into stardom. Mitch went and took 2 years off to go, you know, do his mission. And so he was a hot commodity. So we pursued him and we got him on the team, and you know, and we got his friend Brandon Bybee on the team, and it just kept going, you know, and
it was a sick team. Yeah.
It was great. I mean, it all sort of the great sort of, I mean, I don't want to leave Risto Scott out. He was also
right.
on, he was on MLY, and he was like, kind of like, he was a ripper and a cool freestyle kid, but sort of knew MLY wasn't the coolest thing, but we all have to take whatever chances, advantages we can, you know, or
totally.
Opportunities we can get. And I just remember him kind of being like, can I be on the program? And like, we're like, yeah, you know, yeah. And he was really good at snowboarding.
Yes.
So it made sense. And that's the thing, is it's amazing how you could take a name like Risto, who when he was on MLY, I don't think was a cool guy. We put him on M3 and he became I thought he was a cool guy.
Yeah,
and
for
like,
sure, for sure.
Suddenly he's in a Whitey movie and
totally.
Has like, gets sponsored by Billabong and all these other things. And like, style's good and like was ripping, you know.
Yeah,
so,
I remember the Molly,
right,
because
right.
we were saying like we can't sell Molly snowboards, it just
right,
sounds
right.
dumb. Then they're like ML, well, that's cool. And then
yeah.
there was M3, and I think that affiliation, like had you not had Molly MLY, I think if it,
yeah.
the brand had just started out of nowhere, I think it would yeah. have just gone, like it'd still be around maybe even. Like it was,
it
was good,
I
dude.
Mean, I appreciate that sentiment. But actually what happened was when I was, you know, the person speaking with the graphic designer, like, I was basically the creative director and just going over everything. By the end of it, I took everything MLY off it. It just had this little squiggle logo that they had
mm-hmm.
on the tail, like really small and like light gray on white. So yeah. by the end, M3 was its own thing.
Oh, totally.
And after it came out, we sold so many boards immediately that they were like, okay. And the crazy thing was like, they gave me this contract where they were like, oh, we'll pay you $25,000 a year and 10 bucks a board. We'll pay you $20,000 a year and 25 bucks a board. And I was like, okay. And I took that money and like gave it to all the, like I split it out. Like Chad got a bunch, you know, Mitch got some. When we got Mikey on the program, he got some. I kept some. And like, we ended up, it went so big that I know that like my obligations to some of my friends who stuck by me would definitely, it went well for a couple of years.
Yeah,
I wish it would have went well longer, but
yeah,
it was all right.
Yeah, I think
and that felt good.
That there's an era. There's an M3 era. Like when you guys had the BMW graphic and like that insane team. Like in those Whitey films, especially like looking at Revival, watching Revival, I was like, wow, M3 was it, dude.
Yeah, Revival. Well, interesting. I don't want to be autocorrect, but I think the BMW was the Matt Smith board, dude, on Silence. So that was the Matt Smith.
You're absolutely right. You are right.
Yeah.
Right. And I mix up the Silence and M3 thing because you were on both. Right, right,
I mean,
right.
Silence was cool, like when brands were cool, like,
yeah,
Type A and Joyride and Atlantis and all those. And then M3, we were definitely thinking about those types of brands because snowboarding went through like this kind of Olympic half pipe. Everyone got super into like riding a lot of forward lean and like riding a lot of half pipe.
And
riding for Salomon or something, which,
right,
you know, Salomon's cool, but it wasn't at the time, it wasn't like one of those other brands. And so we saw form work and we were like, it's possible, you know, I got to say, like, I don't know if Peter Line doesn't start form, I don't think I start M3, like, no way.
Rad.
Seeing that it was possible made us feel like it was possible and to have a cool rider inspired brand because so many of them had folded prior to that.
Totally.
And at that time, I feel like it was Burton and Solomon and K2 like vying to be, you know, and all those brands are fine. Like they're
and
all
ride.
Just snowboard.
Right. Yeah. Yeah.
And,
yeah,
and maybe
totally.
Ride. Yeah.
Totally.
But then, and like now, snowboarding's in a place where anyone that makes a snowboard sort of should get credit for it, I feel like. But at the time, you know, we had our like, oh, that's a ski brand or that's a this or that or whatever. I don't know. Anyway.
Oh, yeah, right, right.
You know, it was for sure when you're a kid, Joyride is cooler than K2. You know, when you're 19 and 1992.
Oh, absolutely.
Joyride is cooler than K2. Like, that's just the way it is.
Yeah.
But at this point, anyone that's in a game for as long as any of those brands have been in it deserves respect because it's not an easy game. It's not
absolutely,
easy. Not easy, you know. But,
yeah. Yeah. Well, I did a tiny bit of research for this, and the X Games profile came up actually, and something about the fine art thing, and in the article that I read about the fine art. You mentioned
we can just call it art.
Art. Yeah, yeah.
People. I said it offhand because
yeah.
Art.
So
people can decide if it's fine or not.
Right.
On their own.
Right. So you mentioned that there are people who can tell what a switch backside 180, a properly done switch backside 180 is. That's like, those are the enthusiasts. Those are the people that live the sport, as opposed to anyone can see, you know, a backside rodeo and go like, wow, that guy went upside down. That's from some interview, but it's like the legitimacy of snowboarding. M3 was it. That's the thing, is that like,
I feel like it.
Yeah. Sure. Wasn't there a time where Noah joined the team, or was that MLI?
No. So what happened was Noah, Nate Cole, and Brad Schaffel and Jimmy Halipoff, they tried to revamp MLY and they got all those dudes on the team.
Okay.
And I feel like some of those guys were a little past their like peak filming time. Like, reality is like Nate Cole is not like all those dudes were still probably might have even still been better snowboarders than me. Like some of those dudes had really just, Jimmy Halipoff was good.
Oh yeah.
Noah Slazik was good. Nate Cole was good. Like those guys just had an innate like talent that like, I don't know if I ever had that. I tried really hard is what I did. You know, like I hiked the jump till I got it exactly how
yes.
I wanted.
Yes.
Those guys. So like those guys, but I feel like those guys were maybe not at the very peak of their fame. And so MLY was like a chance for them to get a deal, for them to kind of offer some legitimacy.
Yep.
And they tried to do that. I don't think it worked in the end, which none of it worked because none of those brands are here anymore. But that was how that happened.
Oh, that makes sense. Yeah. Cause I remember meeting Selaznik at that point. He came up to a snow show or something. He was in a Warren Miller film.
Really?
It was like really random. And sure. seeing him and talking about it, and you could just tell from his, the way he talked about it, he wasn't excited about it. He's like, yeah, it's a paycheck. Yeah, he
wasn't. That was like, right. And that was an era too where, like, I think, like, it was just like they were trying to have, like, kind of, they were trying to maybe push the casual side of snowboarding too or something. I don't know what.
Yeah.
I can't speak to all that. We were so, like, up to our necks in M3 and how it was going and doing, like, filming with Whitey and all that,
yeah. So you're running the company, you're filming and designing.
Running is a strong word. I am creatively, you know, sort of guiding the company initially, especially.
Yeah.
But some other very creative dudes become involved, and that's like Scott Zergabel, who was at part of MLY already.
Yeah.
Who, I don't know if you know who he is, but he went on to found Holden. With Mikey LeBlanc.
With Mikey. Oh, no way. Yeah. Dope. Yeah.
And so Scotty was like, or Scott was like, he was like their like product manager or something. I'm not really sure what. And we, you know, like some of the people when we came on board were not happy we were there. And Scott was like happy, you know?
Yeah.
And it just gave him this room to sort of boom, do all this stuff. And he became like the apparel and soft goods designer and just did all this amazing creative, like corduroy, you know, trucker jackets and things like no one in snowboarding was doing at the time. Like I had all the best stuff like the last year. And then the other guy was Andy Wright, who became our creative director. So Andy kind of like I was like writing, like for me, it was like, they'd call me and be like, what should we do? We have an ad due and we don't have any photos. And I'd say like, oh, do an all black page with a little M3 logo on the thing. And like that magazine would come out and it'd be like, there'd be that. And then like Analog would have the same exact ad two down. I'd be like, whoa, I just thought of that in 5 minutes. I bet Burton paid somebody like $5,000 to come up with that idea.
Totally.
You know? But I was never a graphic designer and I still don't work with computers or anything. So all the creative things I do, it's always sort of through other people. And Andy really was a part of when the brand really like became like our last year that unfortunately was our last year. He was a part of when we really, it like the graphics were so good and he did such a good job of like bringing in these artists and doing just great stuff with them. So running the company is a strong word. I certainly founded it. I certainly brought everyone in that wasn't already.
It's a dream like team. There, all but, the dudes you're talking about. What a collection of snowboarders.
And I'd like write the catalog. I'd still do like, you know, I'd write the kind of mission statement intro. I would try, you know, I would do everything I could to make sure people got video part. Like with Scotty, like his first video part, it was just like, you know, I was filming with Kingpin and like the filmer didn't know who he was. And I was just like, we're bringing this kid.
Yeah.
And Scotty like came out and he was super insecure and would crash every time. He was just like, and the film, I remember the filmer just being like, I can't, you know, I can't keep filming this guy. This film's expensive. I was like, just give him a chance. I remember he lands a switchback side 180 one day out in Donner in the Donner backcountry. And like, it was just from that moment on, it was on, you know,
Dumb.
And he ends up, I think probably rookie of the year. I don't remember, but definitely having one of the most celebrated parts in the movie. And I reached out to him
and said, like, I was like, I'd like to have you on the show. And he was so humble about it too. He's like, me really? I've listened to your show and there's a lot of heavy hitters on there. I was like, yeah, but you're Scotty Whitlake. Like he was a badass snowboarder.
Here's the thing about Scotty. Like he was always super humble and a lot of pros would come off with this, like, oh, this snowboard's not the most important thing, or I'm not in it for just this or that. Like, you know, Scotty's one of the dudes where he said shit and he did it. Like Scotty, like quit DC when he was probably going to make $150,000 a year from it. He like wrote for LibTech and gave all his money to a charity, Food Not Bombs, because that's what he believed in. He like, right. I saw nobody else live out their ideals to the extent that he did. Like with complete reckless abandon when it was drinking whiskey and driving, running his truck over shit. Like he did that. And when it was like caring about the, you know, having a more mature vision for what it means to be a human being.
Yeah.
He did that with everything, you know, like,
wow.
A plus dude, for sure. Like,
yeah. Stoked.
Amazing, amazing human being. And from what I understand, continues to be an amazing human being. So
that's super duper sick.
Yeah. Yeah. I again, like, probably, I think the two biggest things, the two biggest impacts I had during my involvement with snowboarding were certainly starting M3 and what that meant in the moment, and then giving Scotty with, like, a, you know, the platform from which he could launch and do what he did. Cause I didn't, he did all of that. I
Dope. Mean, yeah,
he thought of all of it. He performed it all. I just kind of put the, like, I just put the block under the wheel so he could get out of the mud, if you know.
Yeah.
And that one move probably had the most lasting impact, because I think Scotty, his persona, his choices, his aesthetic, continues to affect people. And I think is more relevant today than ever, actually. And also, you know, and M3 had its moment, but faded. And I think, you know, I would go further and say that, like, snowboarding is probably, from my perspective, in the best place it's been in a long time, you know, cause for, like, when I was in it, especially in the end, there was so much money and it was just kind of gross. And I know there's still, it's not like I'm above money or anything like that. I'll take, you know, if anyone wants to pay me for something I enjoy doing, I'll usually take them up on it.
Yeah.
If there's no compromise to my integrity involved, at least. But it was like, people were really thinking about it in these ways, and it became this production where it was like semi trucks with 9 snowmobiles loaded up driving across.
Right.
Like, it was just like, when I started, it was like street skating, man. Street skating was such a low production value endeavor. Like, you went home, you dropped your book bag off from school, you picked up your skateboard, you were already wearing Vans and some jeans or whatever. You were already, and you just went. There was
yeah.
no uniform involved, that you didn't have to drive there. You just did it. And with snowboarding, like, even like filming movies, like, you know, most of Revival, but like even before that, like Warriors and stuff, we're just hiking off the side of the road with a water bottle in
yeah.
one hand,
yeah,
a Cliff Bar in your pocket. It was so low production. We'd just drive along in Tahoe and be like, oh, that transition there, that little drop. And we'd go build a jump or jump off it, and we film it, and it just felt great. Like, you know, I didn't like it when it became about, oh, we're going to helicopter 14 choppers in and we're going to end up, I mean, you get amazing stuff that way. The, you know, obviously, it just, like, I'd kind of rather just go for a hike or something, I guess. Like,
yeah,
I just like, I'd rather skate garbage than an epic skate park. And I'd rather ride a chairlift than deal with all of that stuff for me.
Yeah.
And that's just my, that's what I like watching. I'd rather see Scotty Whitlake, you know, ollie a rope at a ski resort than see someone do something crazy in a place that I'll never go. And most people, not that it's not amazing.
Right.
It's totally amazing. It's
yeah.
just not my preference. It does. It's not what stokes me out.
It's not relatable. No. People talk about that.
No.
Snowboarding
yeah.
went so far from being relatable to, like, because you're an enthusiast.
Right.
I'm an enthusiast. Like, there was a point
right.
where I could look at the videos and be like, wow, geez, I think if I went to Donner, I might try that huge cliff that Damien and Steve
right.
Graham did, right? But then you right. actually go and look at it, you go, wow, I would never, ever,
no,
ever do that.
I jumped off and I think I landed on my back. Other people have done great stuff off it. I get scared of heights, man. I get dizzy up there.
But there was a real time where you could be an enthusiast and you could film a part if you were dedicated,
sure.
but you couldn't.
Oh, well,
you couldn't do that,
man.
Now.
Like,
yeah.
we could go do all.
Oh yeah, totally.
And it was a rad sort of crossover. Like, they were just all better at it. You
yes.
know?
Yeah.
I mean, all my favorite snowboarders came from a time when that's all they did. You know,
mm-hmm.
like, I mean, for me, the holy trinity of snowboarding when I was growing up was like Matt Donahue, Mark Morissette, and Nate Cole. And it was like those
Sick.
Three guys had the best style, and that's why I liked them so much. And I just wanted to ride like they rode, you know, like, and like, it was clean. Every, you know, Matt was a little more creative and wily, but that lankiness, you know, like, Mark was power. That dude was so, like, I went to Chamonix with him actually, which was
wow.
one of the highlights of my whole career. Yeah. Seeing that dude ride a French mogul field just wingspan out, you know, like knees out, boom, 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 like just raw power.
That's incredible.
And then Nate Cole, just like the most fluid, just best style ever in my, you know, in my opinion. But those guys were all the riding I saw in them was all like an Up in the Ante, The Hard, the Hungry, and the Homeless. Maybe like Meltdown Project or something like that, or the Trans World Video Magazines with Mac Dog.
Oh yeah, them. right, yeah, totally. Yeah. Anthem. So, yeah, there was a few of those videos that just were on repeat at the shop for us because they had the best freestyle stuff in them.
Yeah, and you could go do that stuff like that weekend. Like I wasn't going to be as good as those guys, but I was going to, I had something to shoot for, you know?
Right. So, well, you got to the point where your parts were, you had good parts in MacDog films. Yeah, of course. You're a really influential writer.
I did my best.
You're talking about all these other dudes. And I'm like, well, you know, you were one of those guys. Like I put you in that category for sure of a Morissette or all three of those guys. Matt Donahue was like you, you were the next generation. But you were definitely as eye-catching as like Blaze Rosenthal. Like that's why I said guys in the 90s who were getting married and having kids and they're like, let's what's a cool name to name my kid? Blaze was one of those names, man, because of your snowboarding and you being in the spotlight of, you know, the forefront of the snowboarding movie part thing. You were on 32 at that point too, right? Like that
I was. Yeah.
What 32 era team were you on? Like Kevin Sansalone or
yeah,
Peter
Lund? Yeah. Kevin and Dave and Vile Liloma.
Oh yeah.
Yoni Mackinnon.
Yoni.
Yeah,
right.
I got on, it was just Peter Lund, and then they got Dave Lee. And then I think I got on and maybe like Nick Droz and like one or two other, but we were like the next after Peter and then Dave, we were like the next little group.
That's dope. You know, cause that was a new brand and there
it was,
and boots were kind of so shitty at that time. They made a big impact with that Intuition Liner thing.
That's true. That was a little later. Yeah. But no, they were the first Peter Lund boot was like the best boot for sure.
With the airbags. Yeah.
Yeah. No, that boot was, I remember that boot was being really, really good.
Yeah.
Yeah, man. And thank you, by the way, for what you said about my snowboarding. That's generous of you. And
no, it's true though. Like you're one of the legends, bro. You're one of the guys in snowboarding that had a big impact. Otterstrom, that is so dope that you had a hand in bringing that kid up, because he's now,
I mean, kid was so good. He was going to make it no matter what. Again, it was like the kind of thing where I was like, well, you can sleep on the couch if you come to Tahoe. You can like, but I, you know, nothing was going to stop that guy.
Oh,
and
yeah.
Between him and Scotty and any other, like between those two dudes, which I, you know, probably had the most involvement with, whatever I might've given to them, they gave me back big, you know, in a big way.
Yeah.
And it was a give and take, and like, you know, Chad was, it made me proud to be on the team with that dude. It made me proud to be his friend. Like I'd watch him snow. It's one of those guys where like, and this is, I'm a pretty competitive person. Mm-hmm. And that was a very competitive field. And there's a lot of like someone lands something or something, you're like, ah, shit, that guy's not that good, whatever, you know, like all the lame, whatever from that, you know, from that age and whatever. Sure. Chad was the guy where he did it and you were like, yeah, Chad, you were stoked for him. Because he was just so cool, so good, so soft-spoken, and under, like, I mean, the thing about Chad is I saw a lot of guys that had an added, like, a persona, you know?
Right.
A lot of people had personas. And it was a marketing gimmick, and it was smart. It makes you memorable. It makes you interesting. Chad was always just Chad. He was just completely authentic, remains to this day 100% completely authentic. And he was so good that there was you weren't going to stop him from making it. So,
yeah, that's rad.
You know, again, it was the block under the tire and then they take off. You know?
Yeah. Everybody else is enthusiasts and he's the real deal. Like if you look up snowboarder in the dictionary, it should be
absolutely
Chad Otterstrom. the guy goes more than anyone, and his style is still super on point, and he's always riding, always riding.
I know. I envy it sometimes, but I mean, the times like we rode together, not this last summer because everything got shut down, but the summer before, like at Hood, we rode. Like we'll ride together every now and then. We'll make like a little edit, and he'll put it out, and it's always just so fun. And I'll always try as hard as I can and go a little over, and I'll give him, you know, I'll give him crap the whole time. Just be like, you're not allowed to spin more than 180 more than me. You're not allowed to go inverted. You're not allowed anything you do that's going to make me look bad. You can't make me look like the completely washed up old guy while you just destroy whatever we're riding. And no, he's a great dude, and he is what snowboarding should be about and what I think snowboarding has become about. Because as I was saying, like without all the money in it, now it's just a bunch of kids who like convert their vans, drive around all winter going wherever things are happening and where the snow is and love it. And like, maybe they make $8,000 a year, you know, but like the bottom line is it's like this community of kids. Like I went to Holy Bowly, Corey, you know, for spring break, took me out there like a season and a half ago, and going to Hood and anything I've gone to, like, I'm always just like, man, these kids really mean it. They're really into it. The only payoff they might get from it is how much fun they have that day. And maybe like, maybe a little free gear or something. And it's just, it's beautiful. It's what I, you know, and that's not to criticize Sean White and his house next to, you know, Bob Dylan or whatever down in Malibu. Sure. Like, great, good for him, you know, but it's just rad to see this like complete dedication to the sport and like with no real, you know, no, it's not like all of us wouldn't take the Sean White path if we had the talent. Maybe we would, I don't know, but it's not there for kids these days mostly. And so, you know,
that's
like,
true. Yeah.
You know, they're just doing it cause they love it.
Yeah. And it's awesome to see.
Yeah. And I mean, you know, whatever, Sean White's super good at snowboarding. I don't want to take anything from him I don't want to take anything from anybody. I just like seeing a bunch of kids in a parking lot drinking a beer after riding, you know, Holy Bowly all day, that are going to go drive off and find somewhere on the side of the road to park their camper, figure out how to dry out their boots, get up and go shred all day the next day. And
it's the best. Mount Hood's actually the best for that. Mount Hood is I've never been anywhere that is more like that. Like Whistler Blackcomb, you have to take a bus up. You can't hike to the glacier. Right. So there's no, like at Mount Hood, there's all these little tricks you can do. You can take a sauna and a shower in the chalet, sneak around, camp in the woods, camp in the parking lot. And you go up there and those guys are really doing it.
Yeah.
They're really doing it. It's dope.
I loved my time in Mount Hood. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I went up there when we went up there, not this last summer, but the one before, it was for We Are Camp, which is like what High Cascade and Wendell's merged into, I guess. And and they had a thing where everyone came out, like a reunion type thing. And it was just so good to see all those people. So fun to snowboard up there. So great to just see the mountain, the trees, that breathe the air, see the views, like on so many levels. It was such a good experience.
It's the best.
And I've had plenty of great experiences since snowboarding and had a lot of great opportunities, but I can't say that any are any better than the ones I had. The good experiences I had snowboarding are as good as any experience I've had since. And, you know, snowboarding remains like one of the most fun things I can think of to do, you know, even though I've taken long breaks from it at times and gotten more excited about it the last few years again.
So, Brad, man. Well, we'll have to do something with the show where we do. That's when you're telling me about that at Mount Hood. I'm like, how was I not there? That's my demographic. Yeah. I got to go there, man.
Yeah.
But I want to make stuff like that happen. And that's actually every week on the show, I invite the listeners to donate $5 or $10 or whatever they can donate to effandradfoundation@hotmail.com.
Are we wrapping things up? I wasn't sure if you were.
Yeah, let's wrap it. Let's wrap it.
I just want to thank Corey for giving me stuff and also Andy Blumberg for always being my advocate.
Thank you, Andy. That was so dope of him to reach out on your behalf and say, like, you got to have Blaze on there. I'm like, I know.
Well, there's always people in your life that believe in you more than you probably believe in yourself. And he's one of those people for me. And I'm grateful for that. It's good to have friends that, you know, really believe in you. And then, you know, we talked about Chad and how amazing he is. So
that was what you really wanted to get out there.
Yeah. You hope I'm not too all over the place.
No, I know, man, this has been a lot of fun. The main goal for me is to connect with somebody who I looked up to, tick that box, that happened, and hearing about what it was like when you got into it. I think it's really inspiring for me to connect with somebody that's a part of our culture, like you've been a part of our culture for a long time, and see what you're up to. I mean, we didn't really talk about your painting houses or whatever it is you do. I'm just kidding, man.
It's fine.
I know that you've been really successful with that, and that you're a celebrated artist, which is dope, man. What a cool transition to be, you know, a professional snowboarder and, you know, follow your heart and not have to, you know, hammer nails 9 to 5. Not that there's anything wrong with that.
No, there isn't. And, I mean, you know, art is a struggle in the way that snowboarding was always striving for the perfect video part and striving for the perfect style and striving for the perfect song for your video, whatever.
Yeah.
Painting is the same. And so, you know, I've had my successes, but it remains a work in progress. And I've certainly had to face a lot of humility to achieve those successes. And I think that the measure of humility has outweighed the measure of successes, but I would say that painting has saved my life and given me, you know, I made art before I was a snowboarder. I'm in high school. I was in like AP art, had it like twice a day, and losing snowboarding as a means of self-expression and as a means of creating an identity, I think for a lot of pros is super hard.
Oh, yeah.
And having painting to sort of like painting functions for me very much in the way that skateboarding and snowboarding does. And in that way, I can tell you, like, it helped me move out of some dark times and where you feel very lost and like life has no meaning. And so the thing that it's given me the most is like that same medium through which to sort of explore myself, express myself, communicate with other people that are interesting to me and kind of share my aesthetic views with the world, you know, whether that means grabbing a backside 540 a certain way or making a painting a certain way. I think about them kind of the same way. So,
dude, that's so sick. That's awesome.
I'm lucky to have it.
Yeah.
Well, I'm lucky to have it.
Thank you so much for sharing your afternoon with me and taking the time to do this. I'd like to keep you involved. Like if I do something after COVID where we do a ride, some sort of riding get together, I think Mount Hood would have to be the spot, right?
Mount Hood would definitely be a great spot.
Yeah. So
I mean, if you do it in the summer, obviously it sort of almost has to be the spot.
It's the only spot, right?
Unless it's Blackcomb, but I mean, there's other good spots, of course, you know, Boreal, Donnersky Ranch, there's some good spots with a lot of history, but Mount Hood is just a great, like, seeing everybody up there in the summer and being able to take your boots off at the end of the day and have a beer with a bunch of friends
in the parking lot. Yeah, totally.
Summer evening was pretty amazing. Yeah.
The best. I turned off the mics because I thought we were done, but the conversation just kept going. And Blaze brought up Chris Miller, legendary skateboard pro. And so I just hit record and started it up again. Chris Miller, I have a connection to him. I worked for K2 for a short time when they bought Ride in Canada. At the time, the president of K2 Canada also got to be a brand manager for the Planet Earth Audio umbrella. And so he had to fly and meet with Chris Miller, and he was bragging about how he's going to tell this Chris Miller guy, like, we got to cut all the salaries of all the athletes. We got to do he's bragging about how this is going to go so well. Cause he's like this, you know, a corporate guy. And he came back and he didn't talk about it at all. And
then I'm sure Chris is like, he's so casual, but so incredibly powerful at the same time.
Oh,
that's the thing is like, he doesn't yell. He's not going to overpower you. He's just going to say the way it's going to be. And he knows, and you just
Yeah. Chris Miller told the corporate guy, he said, listen, I hear your plan. Like, I hear you loud and clear. Don't think I don't understand what you're saying. I totally understand. When you're talking dollars and cents, you can't have these athletes. So I'm going to talk to Tony Hawk, and you don't have Hawk shoes anymore. And I walk, and you don't have Planet Earth anymore.
I mean, in a large way, he sort of epitomizes the thing that I loved about like skateboarding in the first place, was that the world was run by these toxically masculine super jocks, like Western and American culture in the 80s. And when I was growing up, it was like, rawr, you know, Rambo and all this stuff, you know, but like skateboarding was the thing where like this quiet, creative dude could have the power. Totally. And Chris is like the epitome of that, quiet, but intelligent. You know, and not quite. Chris has plenty to say, but he's not forceful. He's not macho, but he is powerful. And I mean, I used to have all kinds of ideas too about when I rode for Planet Earth. I'm going to go down and I'm going to see if I can get it this way. And I'd come down and Chris would be like, well, what do you think of this? And I'd be like, oh yeah, okay. You know, like, but I happened to talk to him yesterday, you know, a little out of the blue. Like we checked in on Instagram like maybe a week ago and said, let's catch up. And it had been a while. Just cause I'm not great about catching up with anybody for the most part, which Andy always rides me for. But the thing that was interesting about it was we were kind of like one of the things that came up. And one of the things that, like I said, I liked your interview with Kearns because there's a humanity to it. And it's not just talking about stuff that was important to us when we were 15, it's talking about what it means to be a person growing up and going through what life, you know, what you go through and everything. And I was talking to Chris about that because I was, you know, he was saying like, yeah, maybe, you know, I feel like I'm not interested in some of the things I used to be. And I said, yeah, you know, like so much of being a snowboarder was about, and in snowboarding was about trying to figure out how to satisfy the whims of 15-year-old boys. Like it was, how do I make these 15-year-old dudes that are playing Xbox, drinking Monster Energy drink and whatever, think I'm cool.
Right.
And the older you get, like, 15-year-old boys are fine. That's what they're supposed to be like. But I don't want them to be the cultural, you know, compass for my decisions. And exactly. I don't want my life and my persona to revolve around their interest. And that's part of the reason. I mean, there's a lot of new things in snowboarding where it is being sort of, you know, there's some great brands where there are a little beyond now that those tastes and sensibilities, but I thought it was interesting that he said that too, you know, like with all the different things that he's done and all the projects he's doing, and you know, not that either one of us doesn't still love it, and I can't really speak for Chris, he would have to speak for himself, but I know that just, you know, we're all guys now, and like we're all quote unquote men and women, right? And whatever,
yeah,
like to just focus on teenage popularity contest would be disingenuous and a disservice to like listeners and being able to, you know, and the Kearns, you know, the Kearns interview had a lot of that. So
I thought
you did a great job.
Thanks for that. Thank you.
Yeah. Making space for that.
Well, the thing that Kearns, because he was also an athlete, like Bob Klein, he became an agent, right? So Kearns goes into a kind of, you know, management mode with me. Like he'll say like, listen, okay, it sounds like what you want to do with your podcast is you want to make a difference. And I was like, I hadn't thought that like that. Mm-hmm. I'd never written that down or thought that out loud, but I was like, actually you are right. I do. And so like when I actually wrote down what my, you know, what my intentions were, it's like, let's talk nostalgia. Let's connect with listeners nostalgically so that people go like, oh yeah, I remember what it was like to live in the backwoods of some place and everybody's looking at you funny. And then all of a sudden you're a skateboarder or a snowboarder and you didn't care that they were looking at you funny because they just didn't get it. There was something you got that they didn't get. And we had that. But there is like, that just keeps going. Like now it's like, shit, I kind of don't care about that. You hear it in some guests. Some guests go, you know, I know the day I, UC Oxenden, the day I stopped caring about snowboarding was the day I was buried. And I was thinking of my kids and and I got home and I sold my truck and I bought a Prius and I just never went back in the backcountry again.
I can relate. Yeah. I mean, even specifically, I remember having my first kid and being like, I don't want to die snowboarding. Mm. Like I never wanted to die snowboarding, but it wasn't at the forefront of my thought you know, my thought process. Right. Whereas it immediately was like, I don't want to die doing this.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
You know?
Well, that's the thought. I think you just summed it up. That's right. The thought that 99% of pro snowboarders have, where they go, right, holy shit, I could die doing this. You know, like, it's, yeah, like, right, you start just going like, well, I don't care. I'm going to jump that gap. Chad did it, or I'm going to back one it. So-and-so did, right, that. And then you watch the progression kind of slip away. And then you see kids come up that are doing stuff that you would have never done. And you're like, yeah, wait, right, wait, wait. Do I have to do that? Pros still talk about it now. Mark Solers talks about it.
I watch snowboard videos now. And yeah, I think not only am I not good now, I don't know that I was ever any good. You know, like, I watch what people do now and it's amazing. I mean, I do it on purpose now because I go snowboarding and, like, you know, like I said, Corey gives me spring break boards and, right, he gave me all the outfit and I, yeah, have all the stuff.
Yeah.
And I go and I'll do like a frontside 360 and he'll post a photo of it. And like 500 people will like it on Instagram, which for me, you know, I'm not, that's a lot to
that's
me.
Huge. I know it's not that's a huge. Lot,
but for me, and I'll start getting like, oh, I could be good. What if I like went to the gym? Like, and then I'll throw on a real video of, yeah, people snowboarding and I do it to remind myself, like, no, settle down. You're not any good at snowboarding. This is just for fun. You know, enjoy it. Like, you don't need that stress.
Well, here's the thing. So, this is the thing. You said it at the beginning of the episode. Damian Sanders could come out of retirement, sure, do one backside air that doesn't even have to be as big as a Damian air, and people would, right, flip out.
Oh, for sure.
And so, like,
I'd pay the price of admission for that.
Me too. Same.
For sure.
So what the thing is that we shot ourselves in the foot by forcing people to retire at 24.
Right.
That's what it came down to. Look at surfing,
skateboarding, and even surfing. It is a very unhealthy professional pattern, like professional career course that, yes, we sort of set people out on.
Totally.
And I don't know why it is that way. I don't think it's anyone's fault or anybody specifically engineered it that way. In fact, I think it's the more certainly the more sort of Darwinistic like way that it would sort out. I think skateboarding and surfing have just been incredibly good at actually keeping people around. You know, I don't think snowboarding did it wrong so much as those other people did it right.
Sure.
Snowboarding went out of the gates not knowing what anything was going to be.
Yeah.
And just went for it, you, yeah, know? And so I think those sports maybe had more time, more experience. I don't know. But
a little
I know
bit more soul. I think there was a little bit more soul, yeah, in surfing.
Sure.
I think,
sure,
surfing was the one that really kind of led the way, and skateboarding had a reverence for surfing from the beginning.
Too, though, like, yeah, for sure. Like, when I think of some of the brands that just have still old guys like that are involved and a part of it, and
totally.
Yeah, I mean, I think you're right, though, man. Like, there's guys like we talked about, like Noah would have remained interesting. Chris Roach is interesting as
still,
a snowboarder
still,
today.
Totally.
Like, you know, I know there's
Farmer,
like,
dude. Like you mentioned them. Farmer.
Sure.
He still way, snowboards, right? Like
No, the dude is gnarly, right?
He's
right.
Gnarly.
You
know, I mean, right.
That Farmer's even still alive and interesting.
Exactly.
If you were around for his heyday.
I know, and, right.
And, I mean, for sure, I could name so many names of guys that I would love to see what they're doing on a snowboard now. I mean,
Peter Line, Devin Walsh, all those guys, anytime they snowboard.
I mean, Devin, I think, is still a pro. And Peter, of course, anything he does is interesting. So
Yeah, totally, man.
Yeah, I mean, I'd love to see what Matt Donahue or I'd love to see what, yeah, Mark Morset would do.
Oh, totally.
Mark, I'd love to see what – I mean, I'd probably pay to go on a trip with Matt and Nate and Matt – or Matt and Nate and Mark.
Oh, yeah, like, totally.
Timeless styles. So yeah, no, I agree. I think it all could somehow be more viable and more healthy, but
yeah, snowboarding just, it was built on next year's product. That was the thing.
Yeah.
Like in skateboarding, you kind of like, I remember they would keep graphics around for years and years.
Sure.
It wasn't a big deal.
Right.
Whereas snowboarding, right, was like, oh, you're riding last year's thing. Ugh. Like,
yeah, no, you're
what,
right,
are you, a loser? And then, so
super
like, yeah, being into last year's pro was,
right,
the same thing. It was like, oh, we don't care. I got into snowboarding in 88, 89, same time around when you did. And I didn't,
right,
even take the time to figure out who Terry Kidwell was or Keith Kimmel,
sure,
or any of those guys. I was like, no, they were old. Who cares?
And that's fine as kids, because as kids, we're just looking at whatever's fast and popping right in front of whatever bright light is popping in front
totally.
Of you. You're like, whoa, Damien's got a mohawk and a penthouse pet for a girlfriend. Holy crap, I totally, want that, right?
Totally.
But like, to me, it's the responsibility of the industry. Like, a kid's not responsible for figuring out who Terry Kidwell is.
Absolutely.
I mean, we can sort of glorify like how soulful kids should be, but like, let's be honest. The industry should be saying like, you know, and in the end, it is a capitalist enterprise and is about a bottom line. And if it's not in some way profitable to keep people around, I suppose that it makes sense that it's not done. It just seems like there would be, and certainly now there is like a way to sort of keep people around, have them be involved, have them be visible. You know, like, I don't want to just think that Chris Roach is a part of Academy. I want to see him snowboard.
Same.
Like, I want to watch him ride that board.
Totally.
And I feel the same way about, you know, a lot of people. And so, I mean, I'd say Chad, but I don't think of Chad as an old snowboarder. I think Chad is probably better than almost every pro snowboarder that isn't like winning the X Games or like named Sean White or Mark McMorris. Like,
yeah, exactly. I agree.
Better than, if your name isn't one of those two, right? There's a very good chance he's better than you are.
Unreal. Everyone always says, you know, surfing's the granddaddy. You could do that as a career because some guy in the 60s lived on a beach somewhere in a van.
Also the fact that a lift ticket ain't cheap. The product isn't cheap. Mm-hmm. There's more rich kids that are, you know, kids with a lot of opportunities, and that's not their fault, but they have a certain, I mean, me and my friends were hungry. We were starving and we brought a certain cultural sensitivity to it that like has been diminished to some extent, but I think has returned.
It's
you
there.
You know, I think it's there again, man. Like, I think snowboarding's as healthy as I've ever seen it.
Same.
Product is great.
Yeah.
Like, the stuff I'm riding now is so much better than anything I ever rode in the past.
Totally.
And the people I'm bumping into, they love it, man. And
they
love it. Whether it's the other spring break guys riding at Boreal, like Corey or Robbie or Gulick. Chris Gulick's awesome.
He's one of those guys.
He's a crazy dude, but I love hanging out with him, and he's got the best style. And yeah, he's rad. Corey's rad.
When I went to California, we rode Squaw Valley with Corey Octoon, who would have been on Santa Cruz with you back in the day.
From years ago,
And Kevin Jones, dude. Watching Kevin.
Oh, wow, yeah.
Kevin still just shreds the way Kevin shreds. Like, it's awesome to see.
That was another innate talent. That's not going away.
Not going away. Like, just him just, like, riding down the hill and buttering a little butter. Like, you're like, holy shit, I'm riding with Kevin fucking Jones. This is insane.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I had to say that to myself all the time.
Awesome, dude.
Holy shit. Yeah.
Well, thank you for taking the time, and thank you for being on the show. And,
yeah, it's fun talking about snowboarding, man. It was my favorite thing back in the day, and it remains one of my favorite things. So
stoked.
It's a pleasure.
F and Rad shout outs this week to Andy Bloomberg. Thanks for linking me up with Blaze. And Blaze Rosenthal, thank you very much for doing the show. Special thanks to all the listeners who've donated to the F and Rad Foundation so far. If you can, send a few bucks to fnradfoundation@hotmail.com, and I'll be drawing for prizes donated by our guests. Congratulations to Alex Kacharski, who won the Ross Regbliati prize pack. Send me your address, Alex, so I can get it to Ross and have him send that out. Special thanks to anyone who works in the industry that understands that athletes drive the show. Russell Winfield reminded me of that, and it's often that companies who cut their whole team are a few years later crying the blues about how snowboarding is dying. Kind of hard to feel sorry for those guys. Thanks to all the wonderful listeners out there in internet land, and be sure to come back next week for another episode of the F and Rad Snowboard Podcast, presented by Vans and brought to you by SIA Productions.